Start broadcast, and we are on air. Welcome to Loose Learners, folks. This is episode 2. My name's John Johnson, and with me, as usual, is Mariana Funes. We're both teachers, we're both Loose Learners. I'm a primary teacher, Mariana works in higher ed, and we're both enthusiastic users of the internet for both teaching, learning, and, well, both and other things. So in this show we're going to talk about educational internety things. Somebody asked us a wee while ago why we're doing this, and the answer is because we can, because we love the idea and the potential of this space, the internet, and we recognise and are interested in some of its pitfalls and bear traps and affordances in general. And we'll be here on Radio Edge Talk, the first Wednesday of each month at 8 o'clock UK time. Our hashtag for Twitter is #LLearn. We like to tweet, we like to hear tweets. And every week, at least for now, we're going to be trying to look at three topics, inside 30 minutes. Good evening, Mariana.
Good evening, John. Not every week, every month we're doing so far, aren't we?
Yeah, but I think we chewed up quite a lot of minutes there with the introduction.
We should do one show a week.
Yeah, that would get me, just to get the introduction in. And the first section we're going to talk about is this idea of us being the product. And a link we both saw earlier. There's a wee clue in the background, I hope.
I can hear it.
There was an article on the internet earlier in the month, just after the last show, I think, about onion caramelization. And I'm quite interested in onion caramelization in general, but the whole point of this was on Gizmodo.com, and it was about Google. And the title was, Google's algorithm is lying to you about onions. So I guess this is about knowing your onions on the internet. And the point of this article by a guy called, I'm going to mangle his name now, well, not his first name, Tom, which is quite easily, but S-C-O-C-C-A, Soka, Soka, I don't know. He's talking about this idea of caramelising onions, and he says 5 years ago he got angry about the idea that it only takes 5 or 10 minutes to caramelise onions. It seemingly takes longer,
and he's kind of done he's suggesting a conspiracy by Google, less.
I think it's just a great example of how the search algorithms and the way Google works doesn't always get you the truth, especially at the top. But he tested caramelising onions and reckoned it took you basically half an hour. And could be up to 45 minutes to caramelise onions nicely. And he popped that on Slate, a pretty popular internet site, and thought this was the most valuable journalistic work he'd ever done. So I guess for the Cook audience, that is it. And lots of people talked about it and went back and forward about it. But what was interesting is that more recently, and this is just a short time ago, this actual article was published. It was published in March. He noticed that if you searched for Google, how long does it take to caramelise onions? The answer comes up, or came up, about 5 minutes. And the quote it pulled was the quote from his article, the quote he was arguing against. So I guess Google has figured out that this article was a popular article for caramelising onions, and taken what looked like a sensible quote with the timings in it, 5 minutes, which was actually the opposite of what the article was about. So Google, and it's all its power and algorithmic wisdom, had searched for the answer or something, found the exact right place to look for the answer, according to this guy, and pulled the exact wrong answer out of it. I think that fits quite well with a lot of things we've been talking about, what we even talked about last month, about fake news and following news and how you find answers to things.
What was interesting when I was reading the article also was that apparently as he started to talk about this, when this last article was published, there is a kind of little update at the bottom of the article where it pulled out the wrong quote. And then after he started to talk about it, and other people started to tweet, etc., then you do a search and it actually pulls a different quote, which is, quote, the right quote. So the implication, I guess, is that maybe there are some human beings monitoring certain things.
Yeah.
And it's not just the algorithm.
Yeah, well, maybe they're monitoring the ones when they get bad publicity in something. And I guess that the power of this thing, it was on a very popular website. The original article was on an extremely popular website, and that would have had a lot of energy and juice with Google. I guess if I wrote something on my blog that was wrong, but it happened to come up as the right answer for some things, you know, and that it's occasionally interesting that even a wee blog, sometimes you're the first, just for a couple of keywords or first for a question, your blog comes up first, and there's not that many people interested in that, whether the truth would get put in manually. And obviously Google isn't in the position to do that sort of thing for every question in the world. It'll just be the ones that pop up.
Mm-hmm. Well, to this day, they deny that they do it, don't they?
Yeah.
So I get that, you know, whether they do or don't, there is this big distinction really between, you know, is it automated search? You know, it's not really about accuracy, and as soon as you start to get into it's accurate, and you start to get, you know, human curating and so on, it becomes a different beast, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a different piece of software. I guess it's what Wikipedia or something tries to do, and a few other people trying to read around it. And sort of more seriously, we talked about Mike Caulfield and the sort of work he's doing in America about fake news and detecting it and all the rest. And this kind of leads fairly directly into that, I think. If you see that, how do you find it? You know, if you're just interested in how long it's going to take you to cook the dinner, you're probably not going to dig in and do the work. But also Google's presenting it in a way that looks, right, this looks authoritarian, it looks all the rest of it. And say Mike Caulfield and a few other people have put together recipes and ways of checking facts and finding out things. And I guess we'll pop these links into the show notes for this. I liked the sort of three really short points that Mike Caulfield gave to help you check for if something was true or not. And I guess even then I would probably even take it down to two of those three. The three things he said is check for previous fact-checking work, go upstream to the source, and read laterally. And that kind of fits in, I think, with the stuff we were talking last time about Facebook and the difficulty in sites like Facebook that embed news on their site because they want to keep you there. So they're actually discouraging you for doing any of these things. But this seems to me it's kind of good guidance. I think it's certainly the way I use the internet, and I'm not sure if that's because I'm smart or because I'm distractible. You know, you see a link, you click on it. You know, if somebody's quoting something, you follow it because that might be interesting.
Well, One of the things, I mean, that the kind of key strategies that Mike is using are really built on a lot of the digital literacy work that has gone before him. You know, it's not just, he's really summarizing a lot of work that has been done already around, you know, lateral reading and how it applies to working on screen, etc., for example. You know, one of the things that, you know, you looked at those three, and he also talks about the idea, almost before talking about this, he talks about the idea of, you know, your emotional reaction, which, you know, actually I think is probably one of the most important things to stop us from, you know, just following things blindly. And the question, this one comes from, there is a project called the News Literacy Project, and they have this thing called Checkology for checking news, which is lovely, and it's got some really interesting questions, actually, that I would also, you know, we can put the link there. But the question they use as the first question is, which Mike has taken on, gauge your emotional reaction. Is it strong? Are you angry? Are you intensely hoping that the information turns out to be true or to be false? And the point that is made is that, of course, if you don't do that, you just follow blindly to confirm or disconfirm what you want to confirm or disconfirm, and stop yourself, and don't stop yourself then doing some of the more rational things that you've just listed in those three points that you've read. And I think that's quite an important thing, because of course, particularly at the speed at which, you know, things like Facebook and so on, you know, travel in terms of the stream going through, it takes some discipline, doesn't it, to just stop and gauge your emotional reaction.
I think that again seems to be the problem, especially on a site like Facebook. Thumbs up and share, reshare happens far too quickly. I guess the same on Twitter. It's much easier, and we talked about this last week about the fact that, you know, some people just quite happily just share things that they haven't even read, because it comes from, to them, a trusted source. And
the what I thought was really interesting also was, you know, when you were saying about the kind of, you know, how we check or don't check, you know, things as they come through. But there is, you know, and clearly, you know, around caramelizing onions, perhaps one wouldn't spend a great deal of time, you know, double checking that. But there are, of course, other much more important and significant things, you know, that certainly with students, you know, handing in assignments and things like that. And one of the things that is linked with Mike's digital something project, I forget, it's called DigiPo, isn't it? The whole name of it. They use hypothesis as an annotation tool, as part of the tools that they recommend. And there was a blog post that was published recently in the Hypothesis blog, where they look at all the different tools that they're using for, you know, web literacy in this project. And there is a screencast on it that is 10 minutes long. And in those 10 minutes, it takes people through what does it mean to check a claim that you read. So, you know, an article pops up. They use as an example the idea that, you know, Trump's erratic behavior is linked with drug taking. There is a lot going on the web that is, you know, about this. And so they take this claim coming from one article that, you know, somebody gets on Facebook, and they backtrack and they apply all of these things that, you know, we were just talking about. And the point, you know, that it's written by John Udell, and I think it's a really brilliant blog post, and the screencast is really, really interesting. And I found, you know, that really what was, you know, it's interesting, this whole idea of just how difficult it is to do. So I know a quote from the thing. It's, you know, he says, John Udell concludes in the article. He says, fact checking is hard work. a single investigation can require students to find, organize, and present evidence found online in dozens of HTML or PDF pages. The DigiPod toolkit, which is what they are, you know, researching and working, it's kind of like a template for a course, as I understand it so far. Provides a set of helpers that enable students to power through the grunt work of assembling evidence so that they can focus on producing well-written investigations. All well and good, and it's wonderful that they're doing that. And, you know, how many things go through, you know, past your eyes through a day when you are, you know, scanning your Facebook stream? And would you go and fact check everything?
Yeah, well, we probably don't. Well, we certainly don't. I think it's really unlikely we're going to convince many people who are not actually having to do it to get a marks in a course for doing that. But mm-hmm. I think what we should be doing is thinking about the, you know, just reading sort of slower on the internet and following links and you know, going back to find sources, but not just for the point of finding out if it's true, but just to read around subjects. I mean, the whole point of the internet to some extent is hypertext, you know, that is a document that can be much richer than just the contents of the document. And as well as from the facts checking point of view, I think maybe just from interest, how nice it is to slow down a wee bit and meander through the web and see the different things that you find, rather than just going, you know, there's another castle, let's move on.
Well, of course, what you're describing there, you know, it, once you you put up the intention of slowing down and meandering, that does enable you to create some space and time for doing some checking if you want, or as you say, read around and go back and forth. And taking it back to the caramelization onion thing, you know, it was interesting because once, you know, we decided that we were going to be talking about this, I was reading around it a bit. And it is interesting, this reading around, meandering, how you find things such that, you know, to this day, there are still people arguing about how long it takes to caramelize onions.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like, really?
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, with passion, I will tell you, you know, it's just that, it's just quite incredible. But of course, again, you know, goes back to this kind of, you know, the serious point as well as the funny point, that onions are not that important. But, you know, these things get copied and copied and copied, talking about, you know, how everything, you know, the linking. So somebody reads this, they take this, they put it in their blog, and then it gets disseminated everywhere. And you have all sorts of contradictory things that, you know, are there available on a given topic. So how do new people come and understand to use it beyond just taking everything at face value? And then, you know, the more advanced and in-depth thing that you're talking about, which is actually understanding that there is this immense territory and that actually it takes time to gather up stuff that might be of use. Yeah. I don't know.
I also think it's more fun. You know, it's more enjoyable. It's more useful to look at things and to follow links and to just to find stuff out than it is just to get excited at one thing, retweet it, and then move on to the next thing coming into your stream. We should sort of at least some of the time be meandering and yeah, just all the different things that you find.
One of the things that I have found recently with you know, with my students when they're using the web for learning is that, you know, that this whole thing about confirmation bias is made that much more difficult. Because what they do, you know, even though I tell them that Mary's blog is not acceptable to me as academic reader, And I tell that in many different ways, even if they like Mary's blog more than anything in the world. But they do, you know, they go around and they do this meandering and all of these things that you are describing, but only two, which I think is the point of the DigiPo project, you know, to teach people to go beyond that. The only thing they look for is something that will confirm what they already believe.
Mm.
And that I find really quite scary, I must say.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I have... you know, I'm using a number of the, you know, the DigiPo resources, and I've pointed some of my students who are teachers to it and so on, because I actually believe, you know, it is helpful. You know, it goes back to the whether or not the platforms lend themselves to allowing that slowness that you're talking about and us taking the time to be able to do some of this, you know, searching and finding for accuracy, for, as you say, sometimes because it's fun, because you get multiple perspectives, because you get all of that, but that's not what I observe my students doing.
Hmm. Yeah, if we're teachers especially, we're usually in a hurry. We're doing prep and you've got to get going. So just before we sort of move on to the next topic, and I think we can leave this one we're on hanging, because I'm sure we'll come back to it. This is sort of ironic link of the day, and this is Doc Searles published this. I read it on Medium, and he's got a screenshot of a Facebook page where Mark Zuckerberg is posting about the election and fake news, and the two sponsored adverts beside the post are fake news ads. So even Mark Zuckerberg can't avoid the Facebook sort of Facebook adding fake news to his real news.
What was interesting about that was that, and you know, something that I learned, I guess I don't do Facebook now, but this adverts are kind of just like clickbait. So they are not the content of the adverts is not even what, you know, it actually takes you to. It's completely fake in that sense. It's not even that it's advertising stuff that you wouldn't want to see next to your real post. But it's actually is something that is trying to attract your attention, and I think it takes you through to something like, you know, the way to, you know, the best diet ever, or some kind of, you know, some one of these really crazy things on the internet. Incredible, isn't it?
Well, it's that the screenshot he's got. It's a serious post of Mark Zuckerberg talking about 99% of what people see on Facebook is authentic. The two sponsored ads are for some sort of sports things, they look like, from ESPN.com, but clicking on them will lead you then to some diet adverts.
That's right.
So, yeah, just crazy stuff. So I think we'll just leave the onions simmering nicely or whatever for another, 40 minutes or so before they're ready to eat. And move on to the next
45, excuse me, John, 45.
45, yeah.
Or maybe 10.
Yeah. I tried to caramelise some tonight with rather burnt results going for the 10 ones. I'm going to try 45 next time. The other section we're going to talk about is a bit about open-ed and the way it's connected. And it's probably, at the moment... OER, Open Education Resources, I think, conference is on in London, I think, OER 17, and it's been quite a lot of stuff on Twitter about it, and it looks like a really interesting conference. Last year, OER 16, it was in Edinburgh, and I was lucky enough to go along and broadcast on Radio Edutalk, so I'm kind of feeling a bit jealous of the people that are there. I saw some folk packing on Flickr the other night and stuff like that. So, anyway, we're going to talk about situational factors.
Yes, because I think we kind of, you know, following on from the onions and following on from the idea of, you know, fact checking, you know, we started to think about a lot of this work that we do is really about developing individual abilities in some way. So, you know, call them literacies, call them capabilities, call them dispositions. What you're really talking about is, you know, can I get my students, can I get other human beings to learn how to do something in order to cope with a situation that is less than ideal, like, you know, having, you know, fake news next to your serious post about fake news. And what is interesting to me is that, you know, all of that is very, you know, it's helpful, it's useful. People will try and will learn the best way they can. Coming from my kind of psychology background, this is what I was saying would be interesting to look at this idea of situational factors, in that the no matter how much we learn something and no matter how much we say that we do something, there is an immense amount of research in psychology, social psychology, I guess mostly, that shows that the way we behave in a situation is determined by by the situation and the situation we find ourselves in. And my question, really, and what I wonder about, I wrote a little post around this idea this month. You know, my question is really whether we should be, you know, putting so much attention on how do we develop individuals' capabilities, whatever they might be, when there is a reality that how we act in that situation will be determined not by what we know, but by the situation we are in. And I guess I include in that the platforms that we are using. And if the platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, and so on that we are using are actually designed in such a way as to lead us to clickbait, to click on that ad that sounds like we might be interested, that leads us to, you know, go quickly rather than slowly, like we were talking about, or react to things rather than, you know, take time and reflect. If that is the situation that we find ourselves in when we are interacting on the web. And my question then is around how do we factor in the idea that that is the thing that will determine how we behave, not what we might know or not know about fact-checking and about digital literacies and so on. I don't know. Is this making any sense?
It's beginning to, I think, hearing it. I've read the thing when I got, you know, to words like situational factors, which really just means things that are happening around about, I guess, or the situation you are in affects you more than your knowledge. So even though I'm, say, partially aware of fact-checking, when I'm in the middle of Twitter and things are going past quite fast, I'll just click on something and behave like the average tweeter rather than a person with a deep understanding of what's going on. So
exactly. So, like, you know, you were just mentioning earlier about the kind of, you know, retweeting things and sometimes, you know, retweeting something that you haven't read, etc. So whilst you might know that that's not a good idea, I certainly would say I've been guilty of, as I am reading something, thinking, oh, this is really interesting, John will love it, I'll send it to him. And I haven't finished reading, and by the time I finish reading, actually, it may be completely irrelevant to you. For example, that would be an example of how the situation, you know, and it's because I might allow an hour to read some interesting things, and then I have to move on and do something else. So I haven't done this slowing down and stopping part of it. So exactly that. And there is, you know, going all the way back from, you know, to the 1930s, there is a kind of, you know, a series of different experiments that have been done that pretty much demonstrate that no matter what it is that we, you know, that we say we do, the situation will determine what we, you know, what we actually do. And a famous one is the Good Samaritan experiment, which is the thing that I wrote about in this post. I just took it as an example. It's a classic thing, but there are many. It's not the only one. And they take, you know, people, I'm going to just summarize in just a few words, but, you know, they take people who are starting to become priests and to be very, very good people and help others. And I'm sure everybody knows the story of the Good Samaritan, finding somebody in need on the road. Do you help or do you not help? And so the experiment is really interesting, and the paper, I think, it's still really interesting to read. And they find that actually it's got nothing to do with. So you've got people who are studying to be priests. You manipulate the situation in such a way that they're rushing. Talk about, you know, you're slowing down, that they're rushing, that, the situation is such that now they haven't got time, they can't possibly, because they've got to go and do this particular talk. And actually, no matter what they know, no matter how much they've been told that they have to stop and help people who are in need, they walk past a person lying on the floor gasping for air, because they need to get to their next thing. Mm. And what the only thing that determines it is not what they know. Some of them get a subgroup of them gets told that they have to go and do a talk on the Good Samaritan, and they still, some of them actually step over the person in order to get to the place.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, right? I mean, I think what is lovely about this one is that it's a very vivid, you know, like a story kind of thing, a very vivid example. But there are so many others that show that. And to me, when I look at, you know, open education, some of the talks that, you know, they're doing, you know, on the OER 17 conference, etc., mostly they focus on the individual. How could we get the individual to? Because actually, it should be their responsibility, and we should be able to teach them how to, you know, so on and so forth. But when there is so much in other fields that shows that no matter what you teach people, it's the situation that determines how they behave, maybe we need to be adding other things to what we are studying.
So we have to put people in the right situation.
And to me, that's about the platforms, isn't it, that we're using?
Yeah.
And the design of the platforms.
I was going off on a whole moral thing there about life, the universe and everything, but it's much easier if we think about it, yeah, as, you know, if we take this and just look at the software we use and how easy does that make it to do certain things? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you can see how you can change that. I was thinking on a sort of meta level, well, how do I become a better person? Obviously, reading the story of the Good Samaritan is not going to help me.
No.
Or praying or anything like that is not going to help me. So I've got to just put myself in situations where I'm not in a hurry.
In the paper, I do in the blog post that I wrote, I do sort of write a little bit about that. How do you do it? And and the how really is exactly what you're describing. Mm. They are applying a lot of this to leadership development and working on the whole thing of, you know, how do you develop organizations in such a way that, you know, people behave in the way that you expect them to. Well, it's not by developing their personality, it's setting up the situations that are more likely to elicit the behaviors you want.
So,
but most people don't want to hear that because it affects their egos.
Well, you would have to teach, instead of taking people away for bonding exercises, what you would have to give them is modes of communication and workflows and expectations, I guess, rather than saying, this is what we want you to do, lots of job stuff, and we want you to be nice.
John, that's brilliant. Yeah. Yes, exactly that. So you don't talk about what you want people to do, but you actually have to be ruthless, look at the situation, design this, if you are the person who has the power to design the situation, if it were your organization or it is your team or it is, you know, a place you manage, is that you have to actually do the hard things. You have to design the situation in such a way that it encourages what you want, discourages. Not talk about how well you want people to behave in environments that absolutely do not lend themselves to any of the things that you are effectively telling people they have to do. It's one of the reasons why I left, leadership development, and I stopped running forces in large organizations where, you know, effectively all the responsibility is put on the individual.
Yeah.
To do X, but actually everything around them is set up in such a way that they can't do it.
Yeah.
And so of course, it's a double bind, isn't it?
Raise expectations and... make it harder to get through them.
And in the context of open education, to take it back to the actual platforms that we use, when we think about using something like Facebook for educational purposes or Twitter for educational purposes, what are we really saying when these platforms are designed really to work completely against the things that would be skillful, thoughtful interaction with others. We might, in spite of that, use them in a particular way, but the situation doesn't lend itself to make it easy for you. It's the kind of thing, I suppose, that, the calm technology people, the intentional technology people, they're all looking at, aren't they, and talking about actually how could we be designing platforms that support the kind of dialogue, the kind of way of being that we want on the web. Is not by using the same crap that we've got available, it's by designing again, is what they would say, I guess, simplified.
Yeah, maybe we should have a wee look at that in a further edition on that mm-hmm. sort of thing. Yeah, that sounds like if there are people working on what that software should look like, it might be an interesting thing to do.
In the more theoretical way, what we are talking about, there's this guy Edwards who studies, things like Facebook and the kind of, knowledge infrastructures, as he calls them, to see how they lend themselves or don't lend themselves to things like, open online education. And he defines a lot of what we're talking about as, the inscrutability of knowledge infrastructures. So actually, it's all very well to talk about open education and about, how it's a good thing to connect and to do all of the things that, you and I might say we value being on the web. It's all very well to say that. But if you've got technologies that are actually designed in hidden ways, in a way to not help you interact openly, interact, like take the algorithm, and I think we spoke about this a little, and maybe in the last episode, take the Facebook's algorithm and how it basically privileges the posts that have got lots of likes and lots of interactions and lots of comments. Now all of that is hidden to the average person.
Right.
Yet we suggest that we would use Facebook as an educational tool and think about what it, and in fact I've written stuff about this, and think about what it can create in terms of a community of people where the people who shout the loudest, who comment the most, they're all maybe part of the same community, but these people are the ones that basically come to the top. You never see the people from the perspective of the educator, right? You may never see the posts of the people that need help, but if you don't have the understanding of how the algorithm works, how it all works, you could never actually. And even if you do, to be honest, because it's all secret, it's not transparent. Even if you kind of understand it, you can't really do anything.
Work your way around it.
To work your way around it, you have to live with that. The best we can do, and that's what I tend to do with my students if we use any of these platforms, is do the best you can to explain how it's working and what we know and what we don't know. To be honest, I don't tend to use these things anymore. I'm now, the way that they are designed and knowing what I know, I don't feel that it is ethical to do.
Yeah, certainly that's a question, I think, for all sort of stages of education. I mean, we get as schools, we get free copies of software, free suites, free services from all sorts of people, from, you know, huge corporations, Google and Microsoft and Apple, all provide resources.
Of course,
that, you know, so 0365 or Google Docs and stuff that are taken on by schools or by countries, and then given out to their teachers and pupils as the way to work. Always strikes me as, you know, something that's got a few thorny bits hanging off it, you know. What should we do about that? And I don't know the answer to it. Certainly, you know, for a couple of years I was working on the GLOW platform in Scotland, and it largely consists of Microsoft 0365, and it, so you're taking on a whole load of stuff with that, and it would be if it, whichever platform it was, you know. In school currently I'm using iPads a lot with kids, and that then brings a whole lot of stuff with it. It's different sorts of stuff than if I was using, say, Chromebooks or Windows or whatever, you know. And we make these choices for all sorts of reasons, and some of them are good and some of them are bad, but that decision is made, and then we roll with it, you know.
It's often made not by the people, that not by you and me in the classroom, as it were. It's often, you know, there are often decisions that we just have to live with, because actually the decision making is economic. It's economic, really. It's about money, and that's where it gets made. And so the places where I think, you know, you get a kind of input and, you know, the sort of good reasons, I would say that they're few and far between, certainly. Mostly what I see is, you know, faculty being provided with and made to use whatever it is that some unknown, you know, learning technology department decided would use, and actually not really involving or even supporting some of the ideas that the faculty would want, you know, would have. So it's complicated in that sense. So it's not just, you know, the nature of the platforms, it's also now we're talking about the kind of situational factors that affect how we teach on platforms. And then if you open it more widely, the kind of, you know, when you're thinking about a situation, you know, it's not just the platforms, it's not just the context, but, you know, it has, there are so many different elements that make up what, you know, human interaction is about in the context of teaching, in the context, in other contexts too. And what we are doing is mostly focusing on the individual and saying, doing kind of what, you know, resilience training did a while back in organizational development, you know, make sure that you teach people, you know, resilience skills. I am guilty of having, you know, developed resilience training programs, you know, in my past. And you put people through this thing because they, so that they can manage the stress of a situation, right? But you don't change the situation at all. So it's an excuse for you to continue to have working conditions that really are, well, they are unethical, they are unacceptable, they should be, you know, argued against. But people cannot argue because the only thing that they get told is you're not resilient enough. So the responsibility gets put on the individual. And I'd say, I see that we're doing exactly the same within the context of digital literacy and open education. Partly, I guess, because we have much less control over, you know, we're not Mark Zuckerberg, we're not Mark, are we?
I think I probably, for a primary school teacher, know a reasonable amount about education, but I would hate to actually have to choose the platforms, you know, in that sort of way. I mean, I like having choice, but I'm not sure if I'm, you know, who's best placed to actually make those choices. That leaves us in a rather depressing note. We were planning to do three sections in half an hour.
Working quite so well, is it?
No, I'm thinking maybe we just cut down to two for tonight. and sort of wrap it up and boot the next one off to try and keep this to not half an hour, but kept it to three quarters of an hour now. So if you're listening live, there's a, we were going to talk a wee bit about bragging and sharing and self-promotion. But we'll not
do that next week.
Next month we'll brag and share and promote ourselves. Yeah. Next month. But there's some really good blog posts and stuff out about that. I guess that sort of wraps it up. We'll post this out on EduTalk over the next few days and pile in a bunch of really interesting links that we've talked about tonight.
How are your onions doing?
They're sizzling away. I think they should actually be 45 minutes. They should be done. I think we've run this show exactly the right length of time.
There you go.
Our onions are cooked and ready to go. So with the sound of onions sizzling halfway in the background, we'll hang up the mic. So.